Hello, and welcome to the Idler Academy podcast series. We now present Professor Ronald Hutton on the festive customs of the British Isles.
I wrote a big book on this subject, which I published in 1996. And in doing so, I realised that the reason why I wanted to rewrite the book was that nobody had actually comprehensively studied British festivals since the Victorian times, when the Victorians carried out the great pioneering work of the history of our festivals. And so I was going over ground that often people hadn't touched for about 100 years and more. And just occasionally, I'd find the Victorians had made mistakes and they'd just gone into the truth of the 20th century. This didn't happen very often, but occasionally it did. And I then had uphill work in trying to work out where they'd come from. For example, I grew up believing that Halloween was the Celtic New Year and the pagan Feast of the Dead of old. And when I looked into the actual history of it, I couldn't find much evidence for this. And I wondered where it had come from. And I found that the idea that it was the Celtic New Year came first from a wonderful man called Sir John Rhys, who was Professor of Philology at the University of Oxford in the 1880s, and a great Celtic nationalist, a wonderful Welshman. And he'd got the idea not from looking at historical records, but because he'd gone on holiday to the Isle of Man, which is indisputably Celtic, at Halloween. And a bunch of lads had turned up under his window and begun asking for money and serenading him with New Year songs. He thought, how wonderful this must be, the Celtic New Year. He didn't realise they actually were Glaswegian Hogmanay songs that imported and put in Halloween because they were new in the Isle of Man. But Rhys wanted Celts to have different everything from everybody else. So he came back with this idea and he published it. And initially it worried an equally great academic at the other place, Cambridge, called Sir James Fraser, who wrote a wonderful book called The Golden Bough. But then Fraser changed his mind, because to have New Year at Halloween fitted a new pet theory of his own, that Halloween had been the pagan feast of the dead. And there are various reasons why he had this idea. The first was that Halloween was the feast of the dead in the medieval Christian church, the great feast of All Saints and All Souls, when medieval Christians prayed for their dead in purgatory and rang the bells to comfort them. And he also realised correctly that many Christian festivals had formerly been pagan, true, and also that in other cultures, like China, the Feast of the Dead was held at the New Year. So suddenly, Rhys's idea that Halloween had been the Celtic New Year was really convenient to Sir James. And nobody did any further work on the issue. Fraser puts this double idea into his wonderful book, The Golden Bough, which everybody read, including yours truly, as a teenager, and believed it. So I believed it completely until I looked at the ancient sources. And I read through them. I read the medieval Irish and Welsh literature and couldn't find any trace of the New Year at Halloween. And so one amazing Sunday afternoon in 1994, I telephoned every living expert on ancient Ireland and Wales, and I got them all at home on both sides of the Irish Sea, and they all told me solemnly they hadn't found any evidence that it was an ancient Celtic New Year's feast or Feast of the Dead. The idea that it's a Feast of the Dead is probably a non-starter anyway, because ancient people tend to have their Feasts of the Dead in spring, especially April and May. And there's actually a good reason for this, and that is in ancient times, really like most times, most people died in the winter. And so people who've been cooped up with darkness and cold and very often malnutrition as well through the dark months will have lost some of their loved ones. And having a Feast of the Dead as summer comes on is a way of closure, it's a way of saying goodbye properly to those who have passed and moving on. And moving out, you were kind of clearing away the ghosts and the memories, along with all the spring cleaning that happened. And that's why Feasts of the Dead were April and May. The idea for having one in November appeared about 1,000 years into the Christian era in southeast Germany, partly because the early medieval church was short of feasts around that time of year, end of October, beginning of November. And really, with the light, the flowers, the leaves starting to die, it does concentrate the mind upon the fate of the soul and death. And so these German monks thought up the idea of having a feast of the dead. A pope heard of it, liked it, and made it official. And so it slowly spread. And so that's where it came from. That's, I say, an example. I won't have another example, I promise you, I hope, of things I amended. But what I could do, doing that work over again, was discover the solid stuff that Victorians had got right and that I could add going along with my story. So we can go around the year now and look at the real ancient festivals of Britain. And the greatest of all is the winter solstice. It's the one that's approaching, which is why everything is freezing out there at the moment. When I published my book, the customs of the winter solstice took up one-fifth of the entire book. It was the festive season par excellence in ancient times, just as it is now. And it was the new year, also, just as it is now, for the pagan Romans, Germans, Vikings, Welsh, and Irish. The one thing that's behind the idea of the new year, which it does work, is that winter is the first season. The reckoning of the seasons begins with winter as you go round, and Halloween is the beginning of winter. But its midst was where people put the wishing people Happy New Year and where they dated their years. And what we have now is actually very similar to what the Romans had. They had a twin peak festival. On the 17th of December, they started Saturnalia, which is all about boozing and eating and making merry and being silly. And they stopped that on the 23rd of December and held their breath because they'd entered the winter solstice. Nowadays, when we have scientific instruments, we can say the winter solstice of 2012 will be at 1:48 a.m. on the 21st of December. You can't do that until the 19th century, when you have the proper scientific instruments to measure it. What seems to happen to the eye is something far more imposing, and that is that all through the year, for most of the time, the sun moves along the horizon, rising and setting. That's why days get shorter or longer. But the movement of the sun slows down at midsummer and midwinter, and on the 20th of December, it seems to stop. It seems to rise and set at exactly the same point to the naked eye on the horizon until the morning of the 25th, when if you've got really good eyes and really clear skies, you can see it started to move again. The days are going to get longer from that point onwards. As what the Romans did was they prepared for the solstice and went into it. And on the 23rd, they called silence and had a gap. And then they saw the light beginning to grow. And a week afterwards, on the 31st of December, 1st of January, they held a birthday party for the year and the recovering sun, which they called Calendae, the new year. And so they had a twin peak festival, rather like our modern Christmas, which happens a bit later than Saturnalia and New Year. So that kind of shivery feeling that so many of us get as the clock ticks towards midnight on New Year's Eve is thousands of years old. It genuinely is ancient. So what is the Midwinter Festival all about? It's basically just about three major things, and all the customs, even if they change a bit from century to century, spin off from these. Number one, and tonight of all nights we can understand it, is keeping cheerful. In the gloomiest, most claustrophobic, most frigid, and certainly the darkest season of the year. And because there's want out there in nature, at the heart of the Midwinter Festival is feasting. That is the bottom line. That's the great ingredient in everybody's celebration of it. And so the New Year's feast, or the Midwinter feast, is there right as history begins. It's also a time of dark and cold, so people would light up their homes and their temples and then their churches really brilliantly. That's why they have an extra big log for the fire, the Yule log. That's why they have the biggest candles of the year, the Christmas candles, blazing in the home. They'd light up their temples and churches in the same way. And because the branches are now bare and a uniform brown or dun, They'd gather what little was green out there and bring it home or to their temples or churches to decorate them. So you'd have the green of the leaves and often the red of the holly berries to symbolise continuing life. And usually the plants they brought home were holly and ivy, because that's simply the two evergreens you find most commonly in Northern Europe. Mistletoe was quite rare until the 18th century, when it became a London craze, and we've added that ever since. But holly and ivy, as the old carol says, are the basic midwinter greens. Second thing about midwinter is hope and fear for the new year. And so with hope and fear for the new year, you bless your houses in different ways, purify and encourage. And how you do this depends on where you live in Britain. Above the Highland Line and the Gaelic part of Scotland, you would sawm, which means you'd burn juniper, which has this kind of smoky, smarty, acrid smoke, and take it from room to room around your farm to drive away bad luck. Below the Highland Line, in southern Scotland and northern England, which are one cultural zone a lot of the time when it comes to ballads and festivals, you'd have the custom of the first foot, whereby the first person to cross your threshold at New Year would be the person who blessed your home. Now, who this person was varied extraordinarily from place to place. There is no such thing as a fixed folklore. So, in the Scottish Lowlands alone, one village would believe passionately a redhead person was really bad news. Don't ever let a redhead in, first person after New Year. In another village, maybe 10 miles away, the redhead person was what you wanted. You'd pay a redhead person to turn up and bless your house. So it goes on from place to place. But the first foot is what the North Country does at New Year, and it's its midwinter blessing. And down the south, especially in the West Country, where I live, we add wassailing, which consists of singing to your home, and whatever you produce. If you're a beekeeper, you sing to your beehives and bees. If you're an apple grower or a pear grower, you sing to your trees. If you grow corn, you sing to your fields. If you keep livestock, you go into the stables and the folds and you sing to your sheep and your cattle to be fruitful and happy in the coming year. The most common apple wassailing rhyme, which I use on my apple and pear trees, is young apple tree, or if it's not young, old apple tree, we wassail thee, that thou mayst bud, and that thou mayst blow, and that thou mayst bear apples anew, hats full, caps full, 3 bushel barrels full, hurrah! And then we shout to scare away bad luck from the tree's branches, and pour cider on its roots or perry to encourage it to be fruitful, and dip bread in the cider or perry and put it in the branches, which seems to make the birds sing more brightly when they peck at it. And they do seem extraordinarily happy, otherwise would have stopped long ago. Third is peace. Because it's the darkest, muddiest, most stormy time of year, people can't get around much. Which means, of course, you are held penned into your neighbourhood and often at your infields and your farm or your village or hamlet. But it also means that the time of year when you're safest from evil human beings, armies cannot march, pirates cannot sail, raiding fleets are penned in port, even brigands and robbers not could be hanging around on the highway because they'll freeze. Which means you can be less afraid of other people and let your hair down. So misrule is the third characteristic of the season. The Romans had their Saturnalia king, who would be a slave in a household, who would be put in charge of it for the time of Saturnalia and control the mistress and the master and arrange the slaves to run everything. The medieval church had the Feast of Fools, where the junior clergy would take over the cathedral, or the boy bishop, a choir boy, who would be put in place of the bishop for the 12 days of Christmas. School teachers would be barred out of their classrooms. The school children would barricade the classroom, and if they could hold out for 2 days of siege against the teacher, they got an extra holiday as their reward. And so it goes on. And finally, charity. For a double reason. At a time when feasting is the bedrock activity of the festival, there'll always be people in most communities who are too old, too ill, too poor to be able to afford to treat themselves to a feast. And common human kindness and mercy indicate that people should give to those people and help them. And if the people concerned were able-bodied or liable to get well, there could be the chance they'd cut your throat later on if you let them starve for a while at Christmas, at midwinter, the older feasts. And so that's why charity is the fourth feature. That's why carols, which were seasonal songs found everywhere at festivals in the year, became confined to Christmas, that season, because people would sing beautifully and they'd entertain, and thereby they get a reward if they were not themselves old or diseased, but simply poor. That's why there are more plays at that time than any other time, like the mummer's play, more dances like the sword dance. There'd be ways in which poor people who weren't disabled could actually go and keep their pride by entertaining the rich and getting food and drink and, in later centuries, money in return, by which they could provide their midwinter feast. And those who couldn't do these things, people would collect food and drink and take them to the poor. But in my West Country alone, there are so many different terms for this. Thomasing, going a gooding, mumping, hoggling, hognulling, and so it goes on. So the basic Christmas ideas, the Christian centuries, peace and goodwill to all humans, charity, making merry, are prehistoric. They're built into the festival which we're entering now. And we move out of this in January. Past New Year, a few days or a week, the ploughing season would begin in the north, and there'd be too much back-breaking work for a few weeks. And then we reach festival number two of the year, which is the beginning of the month that the Romans called February. It's the beginning of spring. It may seem ridiculous to us in the north, who can endure a British February, to think of it as spring. But when you think of it again, it is. It's the month that drives the darkness from the afternoon. It's when the really dark long nights begin to shorten. It brings the first buds to the trees, often the elder, the first love songs to the birds, the thrushes and the woodpeckers, and the first flowers, the snowdrops, and then our gardens later, the crocuses. And these are the signs of life returning. So to hail its opening was to hail the promise, if not the delivery, of better time to come. The Anglo-Saxons called it Solmenach, which means the moon of the cakes. The Irish called it Imolc or Imilc, the Welsh Gwylfawr. The only odd thing about the British is they celebrated in different days, in different ways. In Ireland and any part of Britain over which the Irish had influence, like the Highlands of Scotland and the Isles of Scotland, it was the feast of their greatest female saint, Saint Bridget, who was probably originally a pagan goddess. And what you do on the eve of Bridget, the last night of January, is you put out food and drink for her to welcome her to your house, or other symbols that you care about Bridget, like weaving a cross of rushes and putting it up, or making a bed for her in case she fancies a kip, if she's tired, when she comes round your place. And if you do that, people believed, you'd get good luck and a special blessing from Bridget for your hospitality. And then on the first day of February, everyone would drink Bridget's health and have a party with what little left over they have from the winter to greet the coming of spring. But while the Irish and the Gaelic Scots were making merry on Bridget's day, everyone else in Britain was fasting because they saved their beginning of spring feast for a huge medieval Christian festival the next day, the second, which is the feast of the purification of the Virgin Mary. Rather a mouthful. It mattered a lot to the early Christians because it commemorated an incident in the New Testament in which the newborn Jesus is taken to the temple in Jerusalem by his mother Mary so that she re-enters society 40 days after giving birth and 40 days after Christmas gets used the 2nd of February. Why does this matter politically? It matters because according to the New Testament, to the Gospel concerned, when Christ was brought as a small boy to the temple, as a baby, he was recognised as the Messiah by an old man called Simeon, who hailed him in the words that have become known as the Nunc Dimittis, as a light to lighten the Gentiles, which was political dynamite, because it was a text that seemed to prove that Jesus was not just the Messiah for the Jewish people, but was actually a Messiah for everybody, thereby allowing Christianity to spread beyond Palestine across the known world. And that's why this became so politically hot. And in the 6th century, that's about 600 years after Christ's time. The church declared it a feast. And people grabbed it. Why? Because there were two things about it that suited the season. And they divide by the Alps. South of the Alps, February in Italy, Greece, Spain, is pretty mellow. There's lots of flowers. It's a lot warmer than up here. And so they latched on to the purification of the Virgin Mary. And it became a feast of purifying, which you start to get rid of the dirty straw and rushes you brought in for the winter, sweep out things, start to open doors a bit, start to look at the sun and feel its warmth, and feel cheerful about the coming of the spring. Don't do that in our latitudes up here, not north of the Alps. Here it's still pretty cheerless, even with the promise of those singing thrushes and snowdrops and the rest. No, up here it was that idea of the light to lighten the Gentiles. Because in northern Europe, right the way from the British Isles right across to eastern Europe, what they would do at Candlemas, for so they called the feast, is bring candles to church and light them and hold them up against the darkness as a symbol of returning light and a sign of hope that no matter how frigid the season was, and it often really is freezing at the beginning of February, you can hold up your light as a symbol that the days are lengthening and everything's going to get better sometime in a few weeks. And everybody raise their candles after the priest blessed them and sing together. And then they take the candles home and use them to protect their home against lightning strikes and accidental fires for the rest of the year. So a great kind of bit of therapy to bring in February. And after that, everybody gets back to work again. There is actually no sign of any general, widely celebrated old British festival between the beginning of February and late April. Not much happens around the equinoxes. The Christian Church lobbed its greatest feast of all, Easter, into this gap and put it there. But generally, what farming people were doing, they're too busy sowing the crops, they're too busy lambing and calving through those months, and they're too busy laying down, in other words, the basic farming situation for the coming summer, which makes the harvest after that. So everybody is really ready for a party by the time you get to late April and the beginning of May. And that's the third great feast in succession, that which welcomes in summer. The Vikings called it the Summer Nights, 3 days and nights of celebration. The English called it May Day, of course. The Welsh called it Colum Mai, which is the same thing, but Welsh. And the Irish called it Ketsonan. What nobody actually called it was Beltane, because that was not the name of a festival, but of a ritual, which was celebrated at Ketsonan. And this ritual is found across Europe, from one end to the other, wherever people make a living by herding cattle and sheep, mostly. Because this is the time when May begins, as anybody who has a lawn knows, when the grass begins to grow properly. You get to mow your lawn for the first time since October, when you get to late April, early May. Which means that with the grass growing, your animals can eat fresh grass for the first time since October and produce fresh milk as a result. So in other words, you open up the infields or the byres and the stables and let your animals out. And in many areas, this is just a case of putting them about 2 or 3 fields further off. But in parts of Europe with mountains, you move for miles, you drive your beasts up into the mountain pastures, now the winter is there, and live up there with them through the summer. So it's quite a journey, quite epic. But whether it's only 100 yards or 20 miles that you're moving, it's a rite of passage. And the summer pastures are not just green and warm and free. The Austrians have a proverb, there's no such thing as sin in the mountains. But they're dangerous, because now your beasts are out there in the open air. They can be rustled and robbed by raiders. They can be attacked by predators. And as the summer goes on, they can catch diseases from each other, like foot and mouth, rinderpest. And so what this ritual of Beltane was is explained by the name. It means lucky or holy fire. What would happen would be a fire would be lit and blessed by the priest, pagan, and later on Christian, We actually have an early Irish text which talks about three druids blessing the holy fire, which is a very rare insight into a pagan ritual, absolutely genuine and early enough to be guaranteed. And you'd then drive your animals in a circle round the bonfire, or if you preferred, you'd divide the fire into two and you'd drive your animals between them. And those who didn't feel too athletic or too well or too young would then walk between the fires themselves. And those who were younger, bolder, in love, showing off, would jump over them, often jump hand in hand if they were lovers or comrades, and plight their troth for the summer to come to love each other and defend each other. And that's the rite of Beltane, found, as I stress, across Europe as far as Russia, wherever people moved with their flocks and herds. But, as anybody who knows farming knows, the other dominant form of farming is ploughing and reaping, agriculture, an agrarian economy. And where you have that, you don't have the rite of the holy fire. Instead, what people would celebrate in those areas would be the power of the greenery, the power of crops, because after all, the now green rising shoots in their fields are what they depend on for their food and later on their marketing livelihood. And so what they would do all over Europe in those areas would put up a pole, and they would decorate it with greenery and flowers and blossoms of every kind for the neighbourhood to make a kind of super bush or super tree or super flower. And then they would dance around it, and that, of course, we call a maypole. Where you get maypoles, you don't get Beltane fires, except on a frontier, and vice versa. They're two quite different customs from different economies. Not any reason to stop anybody having them both these days. Ever since Freud, people think they know what a maypole stood for, but it probably didn't, because in the old days, it wasn't this great rampant erect pole. It was softened by having all this greenery and flowers bound round it to make it this great fruiting, blossoming, flowering, beautiful thing around which people danced. There were no ribbons on it in this country till 1834, when a Sicilian dance around the maypole, which involved ribbons, was put onto the London stage in a theatre. And everybody in the provinces always do what Londoners do. And so it was adopted from the London stage into schools, and then spread across the country to become the standard dance. What did they do before ribbons? They danced around with their arms in the air. And the most popular dance recorded was where the ladies formed one ring and the gentlemen formed another. They danced around each other in opposite directions, and every time a couple passed, they kissed. You can see the popularity of it. It was the dance to annoy Puritans most, the Elizabethan period, which is why we know so much about it. What you don't get much of, comparatively speaking, around May Day or what's now the Feast of Beltane is sex. Just think about it, folks, it's still too chilly around that time of year. Late April, early May, you can have a heat wave, but it's not reliably warm. Not until late May, the feast the Christians called Whitsun, does it start to become comfortable enough reliably to celebrate in the open air. And that's when village parties and revels would properly begin around Whitsuntide. The sexy festival, par excellence, is the next one in the list. Number four, the summer solstice. How do we know this? Well, the answer is we go to any early parish register. We have parish registers in England and Wales from the 1530s onwards. And all you need to do is find a 16th, 17th century parish register and look for the baptisms, because these usually occur a few days after birth. That tells you when children are born, and that enables you to reckon the conception season. And you find the conceptions are understandably at a low level through winter. They start to rise in late May and they peak in June. Because in an age in which you have virtually no privacy anywhere, that is the time when the grass is high and the ditch is dry and the foliage thick. And so true romance can begin properly. So midsummer is the time of love. Also, the greatest feast of greenery, when the flowers are the most numerous, the leaves are at their thickest in the woods, the time when the fairies are at their most powerful, the spirits of the green, hence Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, a night of enchantment. But also, the summer solstice is the greatest fire festival of the entire ancient world. It's that magical time when the sun sets on the 20th of June and then appears to rise and set in the same place, but with those wonderful things that folk traditionally in the provinces called the blue nights, when you have this wonderful and a clear evening, this aquamarine sky in the north, shading to royal blue, that goes down to a kind of general blue around midnight, with this lighter blue along the northern horizon where the suns are visibly travelling, and you start to get green reappearing there at about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, along the horizon there, the blue nights of midsummer, the shortest nights of the year. And on the 24th of June, the sun starts to move again, the loss starts to move southwards, and you get shorter days. So, what's the fire there for? It's there probably because the power of the sun, which is the biggest fire in our world, the fire in the sky that gives light, gives warmth. But it's also there for protection, like at Beltane. People would light bonfires and jump over them again, or drive their flocks and herds round them or between two of them. They'd carry flaming torches around their growing crops and around their herds, and they'd jump over fires themselves. Of what are they afraid? Well, this is the good news in all this for us now. With all this merrymaking I described, we don't tend to do so much anymore. And that is, we need no longer be afraid of July and August in the way in which we once did. And this is because they were, in many ways, one of the most dangerous times of the year. They weren't the most lethal, because it's a time of plenty and warmth. But it's the time when, if ordinary death is not too much to be feared, extraordinary death is always threatening. Because late summer, July, August, is, as any pet owner knows, the time when insects breed most. It's the time when you're most in danger of being bitten by ants, midges, mosquitoes. The fleas and the lice on your cats and your dogs are at the most common. Irritating for us now, but a lot more scary when fleas carried something much more deadly than an itch. Bubonic plague. You can look at those parish registers that tell you when people made love, and look at how every two decades in an average community, the burials would start to climb in June, and then zoom up in July and peak in August and September, because the fleas were carrying a bacillus in them, which is absolutely deadly to human beings. And lice would breed at their most prolifically and give you typhus when they got it. Mosquitoes would carry malaria as they bred, the ague of the marshlands. And your crops and your flocks would be as vulnerable. By July, the corn is ripening, it's at its full height, which means that a hailstorm, a freak whirlwind, heavy rains can rot it or flatten it and destroy your entire year's labour. And because your flocks and herds have been wandering up there in the open fields and summer pastures for months, they're most likely now to catch an epidemic. And of course, don't forget, it's the opposite to midwinter. The roads are dry, the temperature's warm, the light is long, the seas are calm. It's the time when war, when piracy, when robbery is most easy, and human beings are at their most lethal and threatening. So against all these, you proof yourself, your possessions, your farm, your animals, with the holy fire. Fire because it's that most primitive of power for us. When we walked up together out of Africa 100,000 years ago, having sharp bits of flint on sticks or in our hands could drive off some aggressors. But when you're faced with something that's 12 feet long and has teeth like steak knives and an appetite, to stick a flint in its face is better than nothing. To push a burning torch into its face is much more likely to see it off. We're a daytime species. Fire gave us the ability to see in the dark and shut off evil from our shelters and to keep warm in places where we were never meant to go. That's why it's the great banisher of fear and evil for our magic, our rituals, our people. And so the corn ripens. And with luck, the cattle and sheep get fatter and don't get killed by somebody else or something else. And so we reach the penultimate of our great festivals, the beginning of autumn, the beginning of August. The feast which the Irish called Lunasa, or Lusna for short. The Welsh called Gwyl Awst. The English Lammas, the Loaf Mass. Because it's the beginning of the grain harvest, which traditionally happens in August. in which all over Northern Europe, the first ears of the grain, whichever it was, whether it's oats, wheat, barley, rye, would be ritually reaped and offered up in a temple, later a church, sometimes baked into the first bread of the year and dedicated before the hard, back-breaking, sweaty, painful, punishing work of reaping and scything went on, often racing against time in the hope you'd get everything in before you were hit by a freak storm or days of rain and the lot got rotted or flattened. A time of hope and fear, once again. And if you're up in the high pastures and you depend upon sheep and cattle or goats, it's halfway through the open season. So it's a time for meeting together, for clans and tribes to gather and have sports and games, and decide disputes, and run a dating service for the young people, and generally be a community before separating off to their different grazing lands again. And after this, we have another gap, simply because the economics were against having a big general festival. All those three traditional autumn months, August, September, October. People instead had individual celebrations to end their year's hard work. The first would be the grain harvest. And that's why, because it's the hardest work of the year on a farm, very often it's more than a single farmer's family can handle. And so the different farms would take turns to muck in and help each other. Or sometimes people who could afford it hired in extra hands to help them to harvest. And the custom was, when the farm's fields were safely gathered in, when all the harvest, the grain harvest, was reaped and safe, that the household would thank its helpers by providing a wonderful party for them with the best food and drink and music and dancing they could provide, a harvest supper. And these would be the individual, wonderfully appreciated celebrations of the grain areas. But if you happen to be in a fruit-growing area, of course you reap your apples and your pears in September and have the same kind of thing, a fruit harvest home, but about a month later. And towards the end of September, past the equinox, the seas get rough, the storms begin to become more frequent. It's time for the fishing fleets to return and put up for the winter, the trading across the sea to stop, the merchants to return, the voyagers to stop. And in areas dependent on the sea, it's around the end of September they'll have the great homecoming of the boats, and everybody will get together and tell their stories and settle down for the winter. And last of all, in October, the grass would stop growing, and it would be time to bring in the flocks and herds back down from the mountains, in from the outer fields, ready for the winter. And what this means is that by the end of October, everybody's back into the community with their possessions. Very often, if it's a good year, with their earnings, certainly with their produce that they've reaped in all these harvests. So the last great feast of the year happens at the end of October and the beginning of November, known to the Irish as Samhain or Samhain, known to the Welsh as Nos Galan, which I think is beautiful and is often forgotten, known to the Vikings as the Winter Nights, and known to the English as Blotmanath, the Blood Moon, because it's when you'd slaughter the animals you couldn't afford to keep alive through the coming winter. It's one of the few times of the year when ordinary people would have meat enough to eat and could feast upon it. It's not so much a feast of the dead, as I suggested at the beginning it wasn't, as a time of hard reality, present plenty, and future fear, because now, more than any other time of the year, you've got your produce. You're going to have food and drink in plenty. But you're facing the most dreary and claustrophobic and physically uncomfortable time of year, winter. And it can be a long winter and lead into the months we conventionally call spring. And so what people would do is two things. First, it's the great feast of divination, of trying to tell the future. Now, what we do in civilised times and happy times is work out things like who we're going to marry and if you're going to get rich or not, that sort of thing. What people mostly did further back was work out if they're going to die or not in the coming winter. Or if they weren't, who was? and there are all sorts of rituals recorded for that. But for those who don't want to be gloomy or simply don't care so much, it's a time for mocking fear by mocking the spirits of the dark and the cold, by dressing up as them, or singing songs about them, going through the therapy of confronting what you all hate and fear most and loathe most about the dark and the cold of the year, and just getting rid of it, letting rip. And that's why Halloween has these associations to this day, because All Hallows' Eve became the Christian feast, and Halloween is our common modern name. So, time to conclude. There are two ways in which I can conclude. I always like you to have choices, and I never like to go out on a single dogmatic way of looking at anything. So, choice number one I have is to suggest, as I did when speaking of midwinter, that each time of the year has certain natural traits which make us celebrate in particular ways. So we're always going to want a festive season at midwinter, because otherwise we go mad. And it's a time of generosity, it's a time of peace and goodwill, it's a time of being silly. All those things are built into the nature of the season. And likewise, if you're going to go out and have fun in the open, it had better be from late May onwards, the time of summer holidays, the present day, and feasts in which you contemplate the coming of the dark at Halloween and raise fire against it in the later feast of Guy Fawkes, and festivals to open and recognise the coming of spring or summer. Easter now does that for many people, with a second dose of it if you're lucky and if you're frisky, around May Day to come. So that's number one. One needn't worry if certain customs are not as old as some of the Victorians thought they were, because they're in traditions and moulds and satisfying needs that are themselves timeless and go back in many ways to the first Homo sapiens sapiens to get up to these latitudes. The other way of looking is quite different, which is to ask us how we celebrate the year now. And the answer is we celebrate Christmas mightily, but we tend to do it for the children. And if you're not actually part of the family at Christmas and don't have welcoming friends, it can be pretty depressing. And the revenge for many people on having had their family Christmas is to celebrate New Year by getting out with their friends and having some serious adult entertainment and misbehaviour to make up for the atmosphere of the family Christmas. And this, incidentally, is a deal we made with the Scots within living memory, because back in the time of the Reformation, the Scottish Reformation is much more severe and extreme than the English, and they abolished Christmas as a pagan and a Catholic festival. And I won't do this to you as a question and answer thing, because it would be condescending of me. But just for the record, the date at which the Scots once again officially declared Christmas to be a public holiday was 1958. So what did they do? They couldn't be without a midwinter festival. They developed New Year as their great secular festival instead, hence Hogmanay, with that raw smell of whiskey and fun upon it, and first footing and jollification. And the English developed the Victorian family Christmas for our part and then gave it to the Scots. And so now we have both the friendship side and the family side and the place for children at midwinter. Get through January and we reach February. We have Valentine's Day for lovers. Get a bit further in spring, we have Mother's Day for mothers. Then we have Easter, which is again commonly a children's festival with Easter eggs. And so we reach summer. And summer is for holidays and getting out. The only thing that's changed is that until the end of the 19th century, you celebrate the holiday by staying in the community. Everybody would hold a revel, a feast, a dance as a parish or as a village or as a hamlet or as a bunch of farms. And now we celebrate by getting out of the community and going off to Ibiza or the Lake District to get away from the job and the community. It's the opposite effect, but it achieves the same results. And as we come through, coming back from the summer holidays and settle into autumn, we have a grind through September and October, and then we hit Halloween with Mocking the Dark, and again, giving children fun. Until health and safety came in, we had Guy Fawkes, which could satisfy everybody because it entertains children and allows adults to wreak havoc if they wish. And then, very often in mid-November, we have the carnival season, And really, by the end of November, we're getting ready for Christmas again. So that's the wheel of the year. Notice what's happened. These are not feasts, as the ones I've been describing, about farming and about the natural world. They're about us. They're about children, families, friends, adolescents, mothers, lovers. That scale of community. What has happened is, and I don't entirely mourn this, I'm not going to be nostalgic about it, is that we've lost contact with the natural world. We've lost our fear of it, which is why I'm not feeling a pinprick and then an itch in July and start to wonder if I'm going to die. But also we've uncoupled ourselves from that sense of the unfolding of the seasons and ourselves as an integral part of them. Humanity has replaced nature at the centre of the wheel of the year. And that is the greatest single change modernity has made, and our observation of it. Whether you celebrate it or you regret it, it's happened and taken us in its grip. And that is the single biggest step, in festive terms, from the world we have lost to the world we have